Welcome back to Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And we have with us today a very favorite guest, Bert Bassagnani, who's a wine grower here in Maryland out in Sparks. How are you, Bert?
I'm just fine.
Hi,
just
Bert. So hi. Glad you're here with us.
I'm glad to be here, Cindy.
So, and thanks for wearing your 80s outfit. It's one of the coolest things about doing this program is the thematic dressing for the studio to kind of get the energy going the way it's supposed to.
I had to really dig deep to find this stuff.
We appreciate the effort. I'm sure that we'll get a photograph of you and your outfit up on the website.
That's good.
That also might be a lie.
I don't want this effort to go to waste.
We were thinking about you in context of the 80s because for us it was such a formative time having to do with food and wine. We wanted to have someone who was a wine grower who that I knew well, learned a lot of lessons in the 80s. Is that fair to say?
That's very fair to say, yeah.
So maybe talk for a couple of minutes about your story and your journey as a grower a bit, especially during that time.
Well, I started making wine in about the mid-70s, and just as an amateur winemaker. But in the 80s, I started hanging out with some good friends that expanded my view of just red or white or dry or sweet, something like that. So I mean, it was a great time to get involved in the wine scene because one thing was that I was making pretty good money and the dollar was strong and through my association with a lot of good friends I was able to experience some of the great wines of the world, and it really kind of opened up things for me in a way that I wanted to reach out and try to do that, make a great wine, which we're still trying to do. But I think good winemakers really need to know what great wine is, and so this is the period of time in which I learned what that was.
Did you have certain sort of epiphany wines, benchmark wines from that time that kind of woke you up?
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember I attended a tasting with a group. And we were going through, I think, one of the current vintages, and they were all first growth Bordeaux. And I was, like, just blown away by it. These are the kind of wines that I wanted to drink, I wanted to make. So that's a type of tasting that really had been an impact on me. Another time, I tasted some, at a dinner party, some really old Burgundies that just blew me away. In fact, I think to this day, there was one old Burgundy from 1945 vintage that just burned itself into my brain.
I think it was 45 Clos de Lambre.
Yes, it was.
Uh-huh. That's a shocker.
Yeah, yeah.
It probably died like 9-10 years ago. That would knock you off your chair.
It was. I think I tasted that wine for a week afterwards. It just kept coming back to me. I couldn't believe how good that wine.
That's
was.
That's funny thing with Burgundy when it's mature and magnificent like that. It has almost an echo or a haunting thing that's particular to wines from that region.
Yeah, it kept coming back, no question about it. And then 45 had a special meaning to me because that's my birth year, so it was a lot of fun to drink a wine.
It's good fortune to be born in a great vintage.
Yeah, it is.
You were born in a great vintage.
You're meant to be a winemaker.
Cindy was born in a very good vintage. I was born in an abhorrent vintage.
Oh. Well, we won't hold it against you.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And so one of the things that's changed, I mean, one of the things about the 80s as far as learning about wine in the U.S., was the opportunity you were able to attend a tasting of a bunch of first growth Bordeaux, current release of what, maybe 75s or something like that?
I think it was 78.
78s.
Yeah.
And to do that now is some kind of crazy novelty. I mean, you're talking about first growth Bordeaux, 82 first growth Bordeaux, you know, as a future sold for a couple of $100 a case.
Yeah. I remember the 82. Futures when you could buy first growth Bordeaux really for around $200 a case. The big boy then was Petrus, which was selling at $600, which we thought was outrageous. But you could buy really, really good Bordeaux for under $100 a case as a future. It's unbelievable.
Even as recently as the 1998, 1999, you had a reasonable shot at buying Bordeaux first growth $1,500 a case or less. somehow between that time, between really 2000 and now, you're talking about, you know, 2010s, 16, 18, 19,000 a case.
Yeah, it's unreachable for
the opportunity to have those lessons from tasting, not the same.
Not open to a lot of people, that's for sure.
No. And, well, I mean, that's, I know your heart is also an Italian wine. What did you see happening? Because Italy had a bit of a renaissance at the same time for food and wine in the 80s as we did.
Well, like in the Piedmont, in Barolo and Barbaresco, you saw the emergence of, the new wave where they were using barrique or small 220-liter, 228-liter barrels, similar to what they use in Bordeaux or in Burgundy. They were revising their whole approach to wine. There were still some traditionalists making them in tank or concrete tank, and
they changed their fermentation styles.
Some did, some didn't. I mean, you have like Giacomo Conterno. I don't think ever did change his style, and his wines are still beautiful. But then you had like guys like Clerico and Altari. I think Sandroni, that were using the smaller barrique and a lot of new oak, and I think they've backed away from that a little bit, that they're using less new oak and maybe a little bit more tank. And frankly, I think that's not a bad move, because the oak is, it's not as dominant. And I think Nebbiolo, I think the pure fruit is really attractive.
So as a winemaker and at that time, besides tasting wines from other places in the world, what did you learn as a grower? What did you learn farming and working in the cellar during that time?
Well, without a doubt, I think if you looked at the great wines, the great vineyards, and I only visited Bordeaux once, but I've been to the Piedmont, and I spent a lot of time in Tuscany, the vineyards look great. I mean, you don't see them choked with weeds. You see them well-trained. The canopy management is beautiful. They're just well-maintained vines. And then, of course, the production loads are down into that, anywhere from a ton and a half to 2 tons per acre, maybe 2.5 if they're having a really strong year. I think those are the ingredients. You look at the vineyards, they look great, and they just don't overproduce them. So you get good concentration, good ripeness, and these are things that kind of just, hit home for me, that if that's the way that, you're going to make, if your target is to make a great wine, then that's how you've got to do it.
So you came home from visiting people and adjusted what your approach was?
Yeah, inspired. I couldn't do anything about our climate here, but you got to play the hand you're dealt, so to speak. And we just do the best job we can do in any given year.
Talk about Maryland vintages in the 1980s. Is there anything still alive, or are there wines that were really worthwhile produced at that time?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I still have in my cellar a few wines from the early 80s, from Bird, Montbray, Catoctin. Those were the guys that were, really on the cutting edge.
Those are the stars of that
those
time.
Those are the stars of the time. They got good write-ups in the Wine Advocate, and I think they're pretty much ignored by the rest of the wine press, but because Robert Parker was here in Maryland, he noticed the wines, and he wrote about them, and they scored wines, their Cabernet Sauvignons, in the 90s, and they were an inspiration to me, certainly, and they were going about it the right way, picking good sites, because site situation here is much more critical, and working their vineyards in a proper way, keeping their yields down, and just using good traditional cellar methods, and they were making some great wines. Unfortunately, all three of those guys are history now, but their wines aren't. I mean, I still got them in my cellar, and occasionally we'll open them up, and with older vintages, you never know. There's always going to be some bottle variation, but we've had some stellar ones from those early 80s wines from those guys.
That's great.
Is there a favorite? You think it was the greatest that was produced?
Well, I've always, I guess, my sympathies always were lying towards, the Montbray, because Ann Mowbray was my mentor. He taught me a lot about the art of winemaking and appreciation of great wines. So, and I always loved his style. The Birds were always a little bit more concentrated, but certainly more tannic, so they were a little tougher to enjoy. Bob Lyon over Catoctin, he was a former winemaker for Bird. When they started their operation, he just had a good touch. And it's hard to say, especially at this point in time, who I would say would be my favorite. Right now, it's, you got to watch out which have good fills and which don't. But again, I always lean towards the Mowbray because I loved his soft fruit and
charming style,
little earthier, kind of more like a Saint Julien as opposed to say like a Pauillac, like a Latour or something like that. If you're going to compare them to first growth Bordeaux, I think that's where I would go with it.
So farming in Maryland, and said you can't do anything about the climate. So your ideal climactic year here, say relatively recently, so that people can have an idea of what makes a good vintage for white wine or red wine in Maryland. And talk for a moment about where you are exactly.
Well, 2007 is probably the most recent really great year we've had. Although, 2010, very, very good vintage as well. And even 2008 was also good. We had a nice string there going, I think, from 2001 to... can't remember three. I'm getting to little glitches in my brain synapse here. 2004 was good, but 2007 was a real memorable year because it was. If you were going to dial it in and ask God to give you the perfect growing season, that was almost where it was. We had enough moisture in the winter and early spring, and then things just warmed up and. We got just the right amount of rain during the growing season. Things dried up during the harvest, and we had a lot of nice heat towards the end. And, we got really great ripeness and concentration. So, if you took care of your vineyard, your spray program, your canopy management, everything else was pretty much taken care of for you just by nature. It was a really beautiful year.
So if there's still sevens hanging around.
Oh, yeah, you got to grab them up. Yeah, they're good wines. There aren't too many. We're still selling 07 Lorenzino, which is our reserve cab, but we're getting to the end of that.
Bert, how will this winter affect your growing season this year? I'm curious with all the snow.
Yeah, it's hard to say right now.
Snow's not the issue, right?
No,
it's the
no.
It was the long periods of low temperatures.
The low temperatures will desiccate the buds, the primary buds, which is where your fruit is. More than likely, we probably don't have too much vine mortality, but there's a lot of bud mortality. And you lose the primary, you're going to lose a good bit of your crop. Secondaries will give you a little bit, depending on the type of vine it is, what variety it is. If you're down to the tertiaries, you're really probably not getting anything. And you really won't know until we start to flower.
Is that a certain amount of natural yield control? Maybe if the summer is strong, maybe that'll give you a specially concentrated year.
Well, it'll probably the crop loads will definitely be lighter. I don't think there's any doubt of that. And depending on the variety, some like Chardonnays are certainly more tender than say Cabernet Sauvignon when it comes to these extremely low temperatures. So we expect Chardonnay to be very, very light this year. Cab, I don't know. We'll see. It's you won't know until the things flower and you see, how much fruit's actually out there.
When do you think you'll begin to flower?
Well, probably for us, it depends. We have three different vineyards we're working, so they have different climates.
Sure.
But I'd say probably early May, we'll probably start to see whether the flower clusters are actually forming as opposed to just leaf and so we'll have a good indication probably about the middle of May what kind of size crop we'll have.
So you have Chardonnay planted in two vineyards or three vineyards?
Two. We have it at our home vineyard by the winery, and then we're also at Belfast Road, which is about a 15-minute drive, actually really only about a 10-minute ride from us.
How differently do those two vineyards run during the course of the season?
Well, the Belfast is definitely warmer. It always ripens ahead. It breaks bud ahead of time. Than the home vineyard.
How much earlier? 15 minutes apart.
Yeah, and Belfast Road's really not that far away from you.
Probably about a week's difference as far as bud break. And it's always a point, maybe a point and a half ahead at any given time. So
when you say a point, you mean a point in alcohol ahead?
Yeah, a point in sugar. So yeah. 1% in soluble solids or sugar. But the home vineyard, while cool, we'll let it hang a little longer if the weather lets us and the birds leave us alone. But it's got wonderful flavors there, and we like to have about a 50-50 blend of the two, but our home vineyard's frostier, and so if there's going to be a frost, we'll
probably... So it's a little more dangerous.
Yeah. So we'll lose more to frost at the home vineyard than we will, say, at Belfast. If it's marginal, I mean, we could have frost at both because, again, they're both fairly tender to frost. But the Belfast is just a warmer vineyard. It doesn't have the cold effect like we do at our home vineyard.
Do you feel like your microclimate on your home vineyard has similarities with any other vineyards in the world?
Not really. I mean, it's it's just a cooler spot. And what I think its biggest advantage, though, I think is the soil is rather unique there. And the soil makeup is, from what I understand from looking at the geological maps, is a metamorphized volcanic rock. It's what gave Black Rock Road its name, and you'll see these outcroppings, and there's tons and tons of this rock down there, and the earth looks kind of orange.
Seen it.
We get nice flavors there. It just if we could just get more heat, we'd be happier. But we do get really interesting flavors out of that soil.
Two questions for you, drinking questions for you.
Mm-hmm.
What do you have in your cellar that's kind of like burning on your mind that you want to be pulling the cork on as soon as you can? And what do you wish that you're going out to get in stores right now to be drinking for the season that's coming up?
Well, most of my current drinking, I'm probably just pulling the cork on our own wines, you know. As far as...
No, but that thing that's burning in your heart sitting
in the cellar. Well, actually, I've got, you know... I've been hitting my older Italians pretty hard at Sunday dinners because they're sitting there.
Are they misbehaving?
Yeah, not misbehaving. I've just been neglecting them, you know. I haven't been drinking them fast enough, and I'm looking at all this wine, and I'm thinking, well, you know.
It's time to start drinking
it. It's time to start drinking it. You got to enjoy it with either friends or family.
Call me Sundays.
Okay. Yeah. You can come for Sunday dinner.
I'll make it.
Okay. And you're welcome, too, Sunday.
Thank you, sir. Yeah, thank you.
So and then what do you think? Wait a second! I have this Gulf in my cellar. I need this right now. Some people for spring it's rosé or you know.
Well, Lynn loves rosé during the summer, and I have to buy her a case of rosé somewhere. And you know, I'm not a big rosé fan, so you know I'm out of my depth. So I do take guidance on that.
A rosé you may like, produced from Puglia, called Polvanera. They make a Rosato. It's better the second year. The 12, superb right now. And 13, most of Europe, terrible, terrible vintage, so terrible rosés. You're better off going back and getting the better 12s.
The 12s, okay.
That's a Polvanera. Anyway, that's it for this installment of Foreman & Wolf on Food & Wine. Thanks for coming in today, Bird.
Thank you, Bird.
Thanks for having me.
Nice to see you.
We'll see you next time. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.